Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box.
And I'm Adam Glick.
How are you feeling, Adam?
I'm doing relatively well. Had a nice weekend and got a chance to dig into a couple of new things. Decided to finally check out Tabletop Simulator. For those that don't know, it's basically a thing to build board games in. So there's every board game you can think of that people basically made and you can play with it. But by far, the best feature of it is the fact that of all the buttons you have to use as a player, one of them is the flip the table button, which at any point where you're just like, I'm done with this, you just hit and just whoop. Flip the table, rage quit.
It is a shame that kids of today have to use a tabletop simulator. I have...
You have an actual table.
A tabletop right in front of me.
Nice. So between that and I finished watching my latest Netflix binge watch of a show called Happy, which actually came from sci-fi, which I can only describe as somewhat surreal. It is an entertaining show, though I love the first episodes more than the end. But it's basically, if you don't know it, a guy who's a detective turned kind of rage revenge killer who gets visited by a blue unicorn that only he can see and guides him to do things.
Yes, it's his daughter's childhood friend. I actually caught a couple of episodes of that show on a plane once. I thought, ooh, I might keep up with that, but I have not yet. But how does it resolve without giving too much away?
Without any spoilers, because I hate when people do that. What I will say is you do get to a conclusion with it. And if you like the surreal, if you like, it is from sci-fi, so you know what you're getting into. It does get more weird. Like, I first was like, okay, he can see his kid's imaginary friend and they're going to leave it at that. But it does get more surreal, a little more weird. There's some content that probably isn't right for viewers of all ages. I'll just put it that way.
Definitely don't watch it on an airplane.
But
I do wonder about that. Sometimes you get the content warnings in front of things. It says, this has been edited for content or something. And you're generally wearing headphones, but there are some things like, I'm worried about what happens if someone walks past while I'm watching this on an airplane. I'm a respectable member of the airplane community.
It does take much more of a Tarantino-esque kind of view on violence. So it is fairly violent. It is entertaining. The main character he's a stereotype, but he is a very entertaining stereotype. Anyways, that's what I've been checking out. Shall we get to the news?
Shall we get to the news?
The CNCF has formally announced the first ever Kubernetes Day is going to be held in Bengaluru, previously known as Bangalore, India, on Saturday, March 23rd. Kubernetes Day is a single-day, single-track event that brings together local and international experts to engage people interested in Kubernetes and the cloud-native technologies. The event is targeted at regions with large numbers of community members who can't necessarily travel to the KubeCon events. The CNCF expects over 1,000 attendees at the first Kubernetes Day, and a registration link can be found in the show notes.
Google launched vertical pod autoscaling to Google Kubernetes Engine in beta. While horizontal pod autoscaling decides on the number of replicas a pod should have, vertical pod autoscaling decides what the CPU and memory allocation of an individual pod should be based on watching the code that runs inside it. It can operate in three modes, showing recommendations only, applying the recommendation for new pods as they are created, or applying a rolling update to a deployment to change all the existing pods. Vertical Pod Autoscaler builds on an open-source API developed by SIG Autoscaling, but is a Google-specific implementation of the controller, which integrates with the GKE Cluster Autoscaler to ensure the nodes of the correct size and shape are pre-warmed to run your newly scaled applications.
Have you built functions on the AWS Lambda platform? You can now move them directly to the cross-platform Knative framework using CLEAR, spelled with a K, that's K-L-R, standing for the Knative Lambda Runtime. CLEAR is a set of build templates that can be used to run a Lambda function in a Kubernetes cluster installed with Knative. Environments supported are Go, Node.js 4 and 10, Python 2 and 3, and Ruby is upcoming. CLEAR is built by TriggerMesh, which you can learn more about by going back and listening to episode 28.
Meet Crew, also with a K, the plugin manager for KubeControl. Crew is a package manager for kubectl plugins. Conceptually similar to apt or brew, Crew lets you install over 20 plugins for kubectl and keep them up to date. Crew was built by Luke Burchard, a Google Cloud intern in 2018, and his mentor, Amit Alpabalkan. It has implemented itself as a kubectl plugin and works with 1.12 or higher.
The CNCF has posted the first in a series of postings on monitoring Kubernetes, written by Sean Porter from Sensu. He covers the challenges in monitoring Kubernetes and the main data sources used to help solve them. Porter's concerns are that applications are constantly moving, There are many small pieces to monitor, and the ephemeral nature of stateless microservices makes tagging and labeling all the more critical to keep track of all the parts of your application. His four data sources to watch include the cluster nodes through Prometheus Node Explorer, the metrics of the Kubernetes master processes, the CAdvisor built into the kubelet for container metrics, and kubestate metrics for application metrics. All in all, it's a nice introduction to data sources and things to monitor as you look at smooth operation of your cluster in production.
The Istio team has issued an update on their progress towards a 1.1 release. Dan Cerulli, our guest in episode 15, says that the flood of production adoption of Istio 1.0 necessitated a series of patch releases and thus pushed back the 1.1 release date. Themes of the upcoming release include scalability to thousands of services, multi-cluster meshes, and smooth upgrades. Dan says that the team has begun the release qualification process, with a first release candidate due later this month and a final build sometime in February.
Finally, Stefan Beringer has written a guide on managing Kubernetes using the Open Policy Agent Framework, a CNCF sandbox project for cloud-native policy management. Implementation offers some advantages over Kubernetes RBAC, including the ability to explicitly deny permissions, which he lays out in his blog post. Integration is implemented using the Kubernetes Policy Controller, originally developed by Microsoft Azure, and currently being donated to the CNCF.
And that's the news.
Jared Watts is a founding engineer with Upbound and a core contributor to the Rook project. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Thank you very much for having me today.
You want to share a little bit about your background and how you get started in the world of storage?
Sure, absolutely. So I started my career at Microsoft as an intern quite a long time ago, and I was working on Windows Server and management applications for Windows Server. And back then, I actually was a little intimidated by open source projects. I didn't understand a lot of the build systems and the project tooling that a lot of those communities were using when I was very much in a Microsoft-focused environment. But things have changed a lot over the past 15 years. So, you know, much more involved now in open source through, you know, GitHub made it a lot more social, a lot more accessible. And, you know, some of the storage projects that we've started actually started at our first startup effort at a company called SimForum, which is doing peer-to-peer storage across the public internet.
Is that how you got your start into open source and kind of moving from the proprietary world to more of the open world?
Yes, my start with open source was at that first startup with a project called Mono, which is actually it was an open source effort to produce the .NET framework.
Yep, I remember.
And so we were using that to run a lot of our live services, our servers in the centralized data store for that peer-to-peer storage network.
15 years ago was Windows Server 2003, which I would put to you was the best version of Windows Server. Peak Windows.
I came in on the tail end of Server 2003 R2, and then the first one that I really shipped was Windows Server 2008.
What was your path from server management to the world of storage?
Great question. So the first effort that I got involved in storage was the startup that I left Microsoft for, a company called SimForm. And we were doing a bit of very non-traditional storage architecture where it was a peer-to-peer network that was using untrusted storage across the public internet. You could contribute some of your hard drive and in return get free cloud storage from the rest of that peer-to-peer network. So that was my first foray into storage, and I've been in storage technology ever since that.
I remember that when it was called Kazaa.
I think that's a different form of storage.
Peer-to-peer has the protocol and architecture has a lot of uses.
That was the most genteel answer I can imagine.
How did you end up working at Quantum?
So that first startup, SimForm, ended up getting acquired by Quantum Corporation. And so we stayed on there and started some interesting internal storage projects there, including what ended up being the Rook project.
For those that aren't familiar, can you explain what Rook is and what it does?
Yeah, so Rook could be thought of as a cloud-native storage orchestrator. And so what that means is that it extends Kubernetes with new custom types and custom controllers. And the whole purpose of those is to provide software automation to automate the deployment, bootstrapping, scaling, upgrading, disaster recovery, all sorts of administrative tasks for storage solutions specifically.
Kubernetes comes from the cloud world, and my experience with storage is basically call an API and some is delivered to me. What's it like for people who are running in an on-premises environment?
That's actually an environment where Rook tends to do very well. So when you're running in an on-premise environment and you're managing all of your own hardware, you know, turning all of those disks and storage devices across all of your hardware into a useful consumable storage system by stateful workloads and applications in Kubernetes is really where Rook shines.
What was the state of storage before Rook?
Storage in Kubernetes in general has come a really long way, I think. There's some amazing progress from the general Kubernetes community and ecosystem, including a lot of the work from the special interest group for storage, the SIG storage folks, some amazing stuff there. So basically, I think really what Kubernetes has done an amazing job at in terms of storage is the volume abstraction. So your stateful applications, they need to store their application state somewhere, and they don't really need to know exactly what the underlying storage system is. Kubernetes has abstracted that away in the form of a volume. And so all your container needs to do is be able to write to a local file system or a block device, and Kubernetes handles the rest of that for you and abstracts away whatever the underlying storage actually is.
So what is the underlying storage of Rook?
The underlying storage of Rook is a number of different storage technologies. So Rook, you know, in the sense that it's a storage orchestrator, it does that orchestration and deployments and management for a few different storage technologies. The first storage technology that Rook started with was a distributed storage software called Ceph.
With a C.
Exactly, C-E-P-H, cephalopod. And that is the storage technology that is the most stable with Rook and the most, you know, production deployments, et cetera. Rook also does that same sort of orchestration and deployments and management for a couple other storage technologies like CockroachDB and MenIO and NFS and Apache Cassandra as well.
How would you compare that to something like Gluster file system?
Yeah, so Gluster is, you know, in the same vein as Ceph in the sense that it's a distributed storage system where it's scalable, you can add more hardware at it, and that overall storage cluster and capacity will increase. A big difference I see in between Ceph and Gluster is that Ceph at its core is object-based. It is object storage through and through, and different presentations of storage, such as block storage and file storage, are built on top of that, where Gluster at its core is file storage through and through. It can also put other types of presentations of storage on top of its core file system, file storage, such as block and object, but that's the big difference between the two of them.
So if we consider the comparison between blob storage, like Google Cloud Storage, and then block storage, like the persistent disks, it sounds like Rook provides that abstraction using blob storage, using Ceph underneath, and then provides volumes to Kubernetes in block format?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Is that true?
Yeah, so something really key to remember here is that Rook itself is not on the data path. So when your application wants to write or read bytes to the underlying storage, either through, you know, a S3 object storage interface or a shared file system or raw block device, what it's going to do is actually do that, those data write and read operations directly with the underlying storage, like Ceph or, you know, Gluster or CockroachDB. So Rook does the management and ongoing health monitoring and configuration of those storage systems, but the actual data path is going to be the storage solutions that Rook has orchestrated and deployed into your Kubernetes clusters.
How does Rook handle the ability to provide stateful data? And so if you've got a set of data, if it's providing volumes and a container goes away, or let's say you have a storage corruption, how is it handling that? Does it provide redundancy in there? Does it rely on the underlying area for redundancy? Does it provide multi-tenancy?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a combination of both. So while Rook itself isn't on the read and write data path, so this underlying storage system is going to be responsible for redundancy and scrubbing and durability and all those directly storage related tasks. But in terms of the integration with Kubernetes to provide those volumes in a very dynamic, orchestrated way, Rook does get on that path. So when a container requests a volume, that needs to be provisioned with the underlying storage system, and then it needs to be attached and mounted and available on the specific node that that pod has been scheduled to. And Rook does have a hand in that orchestration effort to make sure that the volume is available for wherever the consuming pod ends up. And if that pod happens to move to another node in the cluster, then Rook will need to do that unmapping, unmounting of the volume, and then remapping and remounting it on the new node that the pod has landed on.
Gotcha. So Rook will actually move data as needed, or will it move the data, or is it just going to basically unmap the volume and then remap the volume on the new node where that pod is spinning up?
Yeah, it'll move just the volume abstraction itself. So it's a very quick, very fast operation. No data has to move around or get rebalanced in the cluster for the pod to continue consuming that storage on a new node in the cluster. So it's a very fast operation.
Gotcha.
What was the impetus to develop Rook?
When we were first starting to learn about Kubernetes and we're talking to a lot of people, one thing we consistently learned and ran into from users of Kubernetes is that a lot of people didn't have a great solution for storage in Kubernetes. They had, you know, integrations with external NAS devices or other external storage solutions, but there wasn't really a very portable way to deploy and manage storage within Kubernetes itself.
Is there a place for using Rook in a cloud environment, or is it something that's only used for on-premises environments where you don't have those APIs, just get storage on tap?
Yeah, I think Rook does, you know, its best. It shines in on-premise bare metal type of environments, or maybe hybrid environments as well, where you have the raw machinery and you've got Kubernetes, but you don't necessarily have that rich set of cloud provider managed services that can provide you with, you know, persistent disks or databases or message queues, et cetera, all those different storage solutions that are available when you're running in the public cloud. So I think that it really is a matter of your environment and your use case. I think there's a great case to be had for using these cloud provider managed services. They're reliable. There's an SLA for them. You pay for them, but you get a quality service in return. So when you're running in the public cloud, I think your application consuming these managed services is great. But then when you're running on-premise or in maybe in more hybrid environments, I think Rook does a great job with providing you with reliable storage directly inside your Kubernetes clusters.
You mentioned hybrid environments there. When you think about people that are spreading their clusters across possibly multiple separate data centers or between the cloud and on-premises, how does Rook help with the storage in those situations?
Yeah, so I think that there's more work to do there, definitely. But I think that when you have these environments that you're spreading your data across multiple data centers and, you know, you have different constraints or different, you know, setups and availabilities in these different regions and different data centers, you sort of need a little bit of a different solution. So currently, Rook does very well with single cluster deployments. But there is more work to be done there to kind of handle that orchestration and scheduling and management of storage when you get to, you know, environments that are spanning multiple clouds and multiple environments.
If someone is running in a hybrid environment and they have access to cloud-provided APIs and some of their machines in some of their clusters, and they're running on-prem and they're using Rook and Ceph to get storage on the on-prem environment, is there a case for running Rook in the cloud, and will it help you port data volumes perhaps between those two environments?
Yeah, that definitely is possible and does help with that scenario. So what I see right now is that data migration or data communication across different clouds right now is really handled by the underlying storage technologies such as Ceph. So Rook would be able to deploy Ceph into those, you know, varying environments on-premise and in cloud, and be able to, you know, set up sort of the machinery and, you know, networking there to be able to share data across those environments. But I think that that can be taken even further, and that that's definitely something that we want to be looking into going down the road, of being able to manage that your portable workloads across all of your various environments in a more seamless way.
What's the story of the name?
The Rook name. So it came, as we mentioned earlier, the Rook project came out of the company called Quantum Corporation. And it was an internal project called Castle. So building on that theme and wanting to find a, you know, a cool sounding name, first off, that is, you know, not trademarked or have any other prior organizations using it, we wanted to represent the Castle chess piece of Rook with that name and logo.
I think the very first hard drive I ever bought was a Quantum.
I hear that a lot when the Quantum name comes up. People say that they used to own hard drives back in the day from them, or that they know that they're still famous for tape storage.
Rook is currently part of the CNCF. How is it progressing through the CNCF?
Yeah, so Rook first became a CNCF project at the sandbox level back in January of 2018. And the growth that we demonstrated throughout the months after that got to, I think it was about August or so, that we made a proposal to graduate Rook from the entry sandbox level to the incubation level. And to do that, we needed to demonstrate that Rook has a healthy flow of commits, contributors, and maintainer team across multiple organizations, you know, multiple vested organizations, production deployments, user testimonials, all sorts of data needed to be gathered. And that was actually a very fun experience that I got to go through, because I got to talk to a whole lot of our Rook users and learn more about their stories and their enthusiasm and kind of get more involved with some of the rest of the community, which was really fun.
And what will it take for Rook to graduate to a top-level project in the CNCF?
The conditions that need to be met to be a fully graduated project in the CNCF are pretty high. I think the only graduated projects so far are Kubernetes, Prometheus, and I think Envoy graduated just recently as well. So those projects, the level, the bar there has to be really, really high. And so what I think we're going to need to do is that we definitely need more production usage to kind of find and sort out those pesky bugs that really only reproduce under stressful situations at scale. The fun bugs to find, right? And I think that Rook also needs a little bit more growth in the developer and contributor community. We have over 100 contributors already on the project, but I would love to have more commits and bigger features being implemented by new people in the community that want to get involved.
You work now for Upbound, which is a company founded to work on Rook. What's the story of Upbound? How was it founded?
So Upbound is a startup company in Seattle that was founded by Bassam Tabara, who is another one of the maintainers on the Rook project, the founder of the Rook project. So we were both at Quantum together, and Bassam left to go start the Upbound venture, I think in probably late 2017 or so. And I was not too far behind him joining at Upbound as well in early 2018. So really what Upbound wants to accomplish is that Upbound wants to be the platform for multi-cloud environments and multi-cloud deployments with, you know, an amazing user experience for managing these multi-cloud environments that the people are starting to move to be able to, you know, have choice about, you know, cost and provider features and the, you know, innovation from the various cloud providers and policy constraints, et cetera. So Upbound really wants to be the platform for managing multi-cloud. Storage is a big part of that, where, you know, one of the biggest problems with being able to have portable applications and portable workloads is the storage component of it. So what we're seeing is that there is a whole lot of convergence on the Kubernetes API and the Kubernetes ecosystem with all the tools and software and projects built around that. So being able to enable freedom to move across cloud providers, a huge part of that is the data. You know, data gravity is a big thing of once you're running in a particular environment, you know, how do you move that to another environment freely, or how do you communicate across these various environments with data and communication? So it's difficult.
What parts of the roadmap are you most looking forward to? Obviously, that you got built a lot of things and a lot more to go, as we've talked about, especially as you expand to, you know, hybrid multi-cloud kind of world, other file systems. What are you most excited about building next for Rook?
So one of the features that I'm personally most looking forward to is in the 0.9 release, Ceph is declared stable. So, you know, we're making a statement that the API will remain stable and new features that added will be done in a backwards compatible way, and that it's ready to have more production adoption than it already has. Another thing I'm very excited about in Rook is more storage providers being integrated. You know, we started with just Ceph, but we already have, you know, three or four other ones now with more coming along the way. So building the Rook ecosystem and providing more storage options and solutions to more users in cloud native environments is something I'm very excited about.
With the container storage interface recently having gone 1.0 and with Rook having now stable support for Ceph, when those building blocks are there, when everything is stable, what things do you think you can do on top of them? What is the, once you've solved that underlying problem, what are the more exciting things that you think you might be able to build next?
Yeah, I think that gets back to some more of those interesting scenarios where you're running in more complicated environments and you've got redundancy and availability across multiple environments and regions for disaster recovery and performance by making sure that the data is placed where the user is, you know, closer to where the end consumer of the data is. So I think you start getting into those more interesting scenarios of performance and reliability across, you know, in a global scale.
And if people want to get involved with making that possible, what should they do?
So Rook has it's an open source project, the Apache 2.0 license on GitHub. So if you go to GitHub, Rook/Rook, we are always accepting new contributors. We love new features and bug reports and everything from the community there. So that's a great place to go and participate at a developer level. And then as a user, you just go to rook.io, the website there, and that has links to everything, you know, usage and our Slack channel, which we're very, very active on, Twitter, you know, all those various means of getting involved and staying up to date with Rook.
Are you worried that a more powerful storage orchestrator called Queen might come along?
That absolutely always is. And her various moves that she'll be able to execute would definitely scare me.
I used to play when I was younger, but are you a chess player?
I'm very, very, very casual. And, you know, I normally don't necessarily win against people I play against. So that would be just a fun thing.
I was only ever at the sandbox level in chess.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Jared, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
You can find Jared on Twitter at JBW976. And you can find his writings on the Rook blog at blog.rook.io.
Were JBW 1 through 975 taken?
Yeah, it took a long time with brute force to finally get to the 976 that was accepted and went through.
Out of curiosity, do you have to pay 90 cents a minute to send you Twitter messages?
Nope, there's no constraints like that.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you can find transcripts of all of our shows. Until next time, take care.
See you next week.